Joining us today is Corinne Kelly. She is the first Pakistani woman in broadcast news for a CBS affiliate. A veteran journalist with more than 15 years of newsroom experience, she has worked with every major network from ABC, CBS, NBC to Fox. Today, Corinne is the vice president of editorial and media lead for Edelman, one of the world's largest PR firms. We chose Corinne as our first guest because we were inspired by her achievements in journalism and, of course, her movie biopic experiences. You're going to hear about her grit, her fierceness, and resilience to become the first Pakistani-American woman in broadcast news.
So you were the first Pakistani-American woman in broadcast news. I mean, there weren't a lot of women, right? Let alone Asian women, let alone Pakistani women in journalism.
Yeah, no, the only Asian woman on television then in that capacity was Connie Chung. She was my sole role model in that respect.
So then, what was it that drew you into the field of journalism?
Well, I'm very nosy. I was a very inquisitive child. Always had to know everything, was always, you know, eavesdropping adult conversations. And I loved writing. Like, creative writing was my thing. Early on, I could see that I had a knack for it. The television part came later. After I went to college and I was, you know, enrolled in journalism school, I had a professor who pulled me aside and said that I had a voice, a presence rather, that would serve me well on this particular medium, the broadcast television medium. And I fell in love with it because I loved the idea of live television, of being able to disseminate information on the ground in real time. It was a huge rush, adrenaline rush, you know. And then, of course, the glamour side of just, you know, being on television.
How did that work, you know, growing up in a Pakistani household, choosing a profession in journalism?
Yeah, that was not an easy path by any means from the get-go. I mean, my parents weren't, you know, strict in terms of academics. Mm-hmm. I was the first girl to be raised in the U.S. by, like, on either side of the family. So for my dad's side of the family and my mom's side of the family, I was the first female to be raised in this new country. And my dad was like, you know, one of the original gangsters of the chain migration. Like, his arrival led to the arrival of his siblings. And so all eyes were on me, and they were incredibly strict. And it was just very difficult because even as a high schooler, like probably my junior, senior year, I was having to bring chai to potential suitors and their parents. For me, it was having to wear, you know, shalwar kameez, our traditional dress, and, you know, taking tea down to these people who were, you know, very candidly scoping me out. The pressure mounted and mounted and mounted to the point where I remember getting married because I was turning 30. And I was like, okay, let's do this. I got to do this. I got to make this happen. Everything was driven by a plan. So to go into a uncharted path like journalism, while handling or juggling those cultural priorities was incredibly difficult, because as I was trying to forge a path and penetrate a business that no one I knew or anyone like me had, I had no roadmap. And then on top of it, I was having to justify my still young career as a reason to not get married right now, because I knew that I needed to make sacrifices and live in small cities where there were small television markets that would take beginners. And, you know, that wasn't conducive to being a wife at that point.
So you were in your 20s, and then you were being pressured to get married to what sounds like men that don't even kind of that traditional background, that traditional Pakistani background. And yet you were still pursuing a kind of a non-traditional career path.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, talk about straddling two worlds. On one end, you know, you have this traditional path of the arranged marriage and meeting suitors. And then on the other, you're forging a new path in, you know, media. And that was frowned upon. Like, it wasn't something that, it was considered frivolous. You know, it wasn't a noble calling.
Who or what gave you that resolve to move forward?
I'm just really stubborn. And if you tell me I can't do something, I double down, you know? So I guess a manifestation of that would be the fact that when I did get into UT and was able to, you know, fight my way to get there, right? My parents, you know, had a son in college. I have a brother who's a year older. He was already at UT. He was in a fraternity. He was like, you know, living his American dream. And so it was very difficult for them to be able to afford two kids in college at the same time. And my sister is 4 years younger. So she was like nipping at my heels to get in as well. And so the financial burden was awesome for them. Mm. And so after my first semester at UT, they sat me down and they said, look, we can't afford this. We can't pay for both of you. And you should be at home anyway. So you can go to U of H. And I didn't want to go to U of H, you know, and I really loved Austin and academia there at UT. And so I put myself through college. I, you know, got grants and loans and worked part-time jobs and just made it happen. So to choose a career where I had to be scrappy, like, I felt like I had already done that, you know. And then growing up in a very small, homogenous community, you know, in East Texas, like Huffman, I had to deal with a lot of not racism, but just ignorance in terms of being Muslim, being Pakistani. People didn't understand what our belief system was. And this was before 9/11, obviously. So, I mean, that still persists today to an extent. But as a child spending their formative years in a small community like that, you had to acquire thick skin. And this is why I'm a firm believer that everything happens for a reason, because that thick skin served me well in a career that was rife with rejection, often based on very superficial factors. And I was prepared for that, or I could absorb those blows because I had a thicker skin.
When I went to college, and especially you going to UT, I mean, it was night and day. You know, you found your people, you found your culture, you had no difficulty in assimilating with the, you know, when you were in transitioning to college.
Well, and UT has, you know, a Pakistani Students Association, an Indian Students Association. So it's almost like a cultural explosion, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Like feast or famine. It was jarring. And it's interesting because you would think that I would, you know, be drawn to that scene and to those groups, but I was repelled by them. Because I rejected the idea of being categorized. I remember walking with a group of, I didn't have any Indian friends until I went to college. And then I had many. And I remember walking through campus with a group of them one night and some frat boys yelling, oh, is there an ISA meeting? And it really bothered me. Like, it just, the idea of seeing a group of brown people and then that is the reaction, like that hostility, you know, today would be called a microaggression, maybe worse. It really, really bothered me. And so it wasn't something that I ever endeavored to be. Like, it wasn't the inclusion that I sought. For me, I always wanted to sort of make my mark. My individuality was something that was really, really important to me.
From college, you then break into a career as into the newsroom. Was it with a major news network at that time?
It was with a network affiliate. So the CBS affiliate in Corpus Christi, Texas, which was an impressive market to start in. But the television station at the time was a sweatshop. There were no benefits. I think I was making $12,000 a year. And, you know, we didn't get paid holidays. If you got a holiday, then great, you get Christmas off, but you're not working, so you're not getting paid, you know. So it was hard in that sense, but it was a great, great news market. There was just, I mean, so many stories like juvenile gangs, drug trafficking, you know, just even in terms of the municipal goings on, things in the counties. I covered a story where I was interviewed for Dateline because it was a landmark. It was a case of a repeat drunk driver who hit a woman who was pregnant. The woman ended up going into labor and the baby didn't make it. And forgot how pregnant she was, but it became this case that was closely followed by both sides on the abortion debate because it defined by default when life begins, whether he would be charged with manslaughter or murder because of the fetus's death. Like, you know, and so that was a very high profile case. And there were others like it. There was a lot of great court cases that I got to cover, which I really, really enjoyed.
That seemed to be kind of a theme though throughout your career. I mean, looking at, you know, you first kind of report out getting into Corpus Christi, you were talking about abortion, an abortion case. And then later on, you were covering terrorist breeding grounds and topics on immigration.
Yeah. The immigration coverage was really interesting. I had a contact and then several at the American Immigration Lawyers Association right around the time that I joined CNN. And the stories that fell under that scope were so varied, and it was just, there was a lot going on. So for instance, there, I remember covering a story about a young man who was an American citizen who married his high school sweetheart, who had come over with her parents when she was 2 or 3 years old. And they decided that she needed to be a citizen. And although she was married to one and she had given birth to their son, you know, in order for her to go along the right path, she needed to go back to Mexico and have her paperwork processed. And so I'm not going to go too much into the story, but what happened was Juarez, which was the world's murder capital at the time, was where they had to go in order to have her papers processed. Sure. And after repeated letters to the State Department begging them to expedite their case because he felt his family was imminent danger, he was murdered. And then, and so that was a story that fell under the scope of immigration, obviously, you know, but it was a very human story and it encompassed, you know, crime and murder epidemic in Juarez. And then, you know, another story we did was on an FBI informant who felt he was betrayed by the FBI after he had been set up as a mole inside a mosque that yielded no usable intel.
Karen, how do you get into, you know, you're a Pakistani woman, you're a Muslim woman, and you're in a Texas news station, and obviously it takes, you know, connecting with people. How did you get beyond, or not even beyond, but how did that play a factor, or did it play a factor in your ability to kind of build those relationships with the constituents or the people that you needed to get these reports?
Yeah. So in local news, yes, it's all about on the ground relationship building. And often, you know, reporters and cops are at odds. You know, when you go to a scene, their job is to secure the scene and keep you at bay. You know, and so developing relationships with PIOs, public information officers, is huge. You know, when you get to the network level, it's easier because people come to you seeking a platform to tell their story, right? So you're not doing as much digging, but you're only as good as your sources. I mean, back then, one of the questions often asked in interviews was, who do you know? You know, like, what's your Rolodex like? And so that was really important. So that involved networking and being resourceful. And I think the fact that, you know, I went from Corpus Christi to a smaller market, Lake Charles, Louisiana, where there was a dearth of news, but a more updated station, I had to be very enterprising to find stories to cover. And it meant localizing national stories. And so then you end up getting contacts both locally as well as, you know, nationally that serve you well.
What was your most successful story that you thought was really driven by culture?
Well, I think that, you know, from a career perspective, 9/11 was a real turning point for me. At the time, I was in San Francisco and I was freelancing as a writer for two separate stations, the CBS station in San Francisco, and then the NBC affiliate that was in San Jose. It covered the whole Bay Area. And when 9/11 happened, obviously everybody, all of us were shell-shocked. But I saw Pakistan emerging as a central player in this global conflict, specifically because of the whole, you know, you're either with us or against us to the president of Pakistan at the time, Pervez Musharraf. You know, he basically talks about Richard Armitage saying, you know, you in or out. And that was a defining moment for me because I thought, I have the cultural context to tell this story. Mm-hmm. I can go to Pakistan. And I knew that they were going to be launching airstrikes, you know, into Afghanistan from Pakistani air bases. And there was a lot of controversy in Pakistan about that as well, because they felt that every time they helped the Americans, you know, they were left with, you know, in the case of Russia, Soviet invasion into Afghanistan, they inherited a whole Afghan displaced population. Mm-hmm. And so that story I was uniquely suited for because I knew Pakistan. I could go there, I could stay with family, and I could read the temperature on the ground and report back. But convincing a news director at a top market station that this young reporter who he didn't know until I walked into his office, by the way, I didn't even ask for an appointment. His door was open. I walked in and I said, I'm going to Pakistan. I'm hiring a foreign crew. I want to report on, you know, what's happening there. And, you know, you can hire me to do some reporting for you guys, or, you know, I can go to your competitor who I work for as well. And he was like, who are you again? And I was like, you know, told him who I was. That was not without controversy. Like years later, you know, I talked to former colleagues there and everybody was really pissed off that they thought that I had been sent there. They didn't realize that I had created that opportunity for myself.
And then, well, imagine being Pakistani helped, right? Being a Pakistani woman, going to Pakistan. I mean, how many people back then were that?
Yeah. And also, you know, people were talking about madrasas, which are the religious schools, you know, where this extremist thinking is taking root and flourishing. Meanwhile, I have family friends who run madrasas, and they saw them as welfare programs by a state that had abdicated its responsibility to educate its poor. Hmm.
So you're at CNN, and then what happens after CNN?
CNN was like, was a dream come true. Like that was, you know, the ultimate for me. And I really, really enjoyed it. And it's the best newsroom I've ever worked in. I worked in the New York Bureau. My managing editor, bureau chief, executive producer, everybody was just, I'm still close to them. There was a shift at CNN. I was very disillusioned. I was experiencing intense burnout. You know, I was going from one mass shooting to another. The budget for enterprise reporting was not being greenlit anymore. We were moving to more talking heads and opinionated pieces on the air as opposed to, you know, just reporting, breaking news, reporting stories. So I worked really hard on a story about soldiers who were committing suicide upon returning from the war, and that their depression was compounded by the guilt and shame they felt from being privy to, you know, enhanced interrogation technique, while our military was publicly saying that we're not torturing, right? And I had some great sources on that story, and it wasn't airing, and I didn't understand why. And my bureau chief didn't understand why. I mean, we couldn't figure out, like, why isn't this story getting the light of day on this network when it's like kind of story that would win you a Murrow or Peabody?
Mm-hmm.
So I was very disillusioned by that and also burnt out. And then I got a call from Shell and they were like, we're looking for someone to lead our creative visual team in the US. And would you be interested in applying? And I was like, well, first of all, why do you think I'd be qualified to cover the oil and gas industry? I mean, I have no experience. During the BP spill, I was based in CNN's Islamabad bureau. So I didn't even cover that. As far as markets, like I covered financial markets and politics, but I didn't really cover, you know, oil industry or futures or anything like that. So I was really confused. And they said it was because I had a global perspective and I was a seasoned journalist and they wanted to bring that lens internally to tell stories and help build out their reputation. And so I remember
that transition, right?
It was huge. Yeah.
It was a huge transition.
Yeah. It was a huge transition. And at the time, by the way, when they reached out, they said the position was going to be based in New York or LA. So I was like weighing whether I would move to LA. And then they made the offer and they were like, oh, by the way, it's based in Houston, but you have family here. So you're good with that, right? And I was like, my husband was like, that's the ultimate bait and switch. You know, from an ego perspective, that was a big shift too, because the ego reporter was my identity. And suddenly I was like selling out. And then on top of that, I was leaving New York, city that's considered a rat race that I never tired of, and moving to Houston, which has a much slower pace.
You know, you have two kids now. How are you managing that pressure along with all the movements and changes that were happening in your career?
So I got married and left New York and started a job at Shell all in the span of 12 months. It was a whirlwind. There was like, and I often say, and my friends say this too, is that my life changes, like life stressors always converge. They always happen at the same time. So moving to DC recently, you know, we're selling our house, we're moving to another city, and there's contagion that is impeding us every step of the way. You know, my husband joked that he felt like refugees fleeing a war zone when we were flying out of Houston to DC, because we were on the last direct flight that the airline had. And I had to remind him that refugees don't get upgraded to business class, but yes, it was harrowing. And so for me, like that stress mode, that sense of urgency is hardwired into me. It's like, I don't react to it the way other people do.
Tell me about the difficulties on the person's, you know, you're this trailblazer globally, but how was that with your family having kids, or what did that look like personally? What are those challenges?
It's interesting because recently, you know, there's a group that was formed to kind of recruit Muslim Americans to be part of Biden's administration should he be elected. Mm-hmm. And I was very intrigued by that, but then instantly reminded that are very small. And that any role like that would be very, very demanding. And one of the sticking points or, you know, question that I asked in every single interview before I came to my current employer was, you know, how is it for working moms? You know, what is the culture like? Is it family friendly? And across the board, first of all, most of the people that I spoke with in my interview were women and they were all in senior leadership. And the president and now, you know, CEO of Edelman domestically is based in DC, Lisa Ross. And she is this amazing Washingtonian. She's a Black woman who's PR power player. So she kind of, it's like a trickle down effect from her, you know? And so for me, it's juggling family and work is definitely challenging, especially in the midst of a pandemic where stay-at-home orders persist. But it's been made easier because I chose an employer that walked the talk when it came to being family friendly.
What would you say to women who are looking to forge their career in journalism?
I would say that journalism is so different now, and it's shifting so rapidly. It has been for, I would say, the last two decades, because remember, tabloid television just launched like 20 years ago. And now, you know, TMZ is breaking news stories that CNN is reporting. It's a very different landscape. And I think it's very important for minority voices to be heard and for stories to be told with that context. So I don't think that your ethnicity or background should dictate what you cover, but when it overlaps, I think that it should inform how you cover. And for people looking to get into the business, I would just say, first of all, make sure you do an internship in the medium or work environment that you aspire to be in, so you can really see the inner workings and decide if that jibes with who you are. And secondly, to be in it for the right reasons. I would just say that, I mean, because I find that people who go in, who aspire to be journalists and then don't or feel that they fail is because they haven't managed their own expectations about the fact that this is an industry that will never love you back. You always have to be scrappy and so therefore driven by an ideology or a higher purpose or higher principle that makes you want to tell these stories. For me, I was very passionate about covering stories that were being underreported or not reported at all. That was my driver.
What makes a successful reporter?
What makes a successful reporter is someone who has an abundance of empathy. You have to be able to connect with someone that you're covering, whether it's an injustice, it's a policy, like you have to understand the human angle of every story. So if that's budget cuts, then the ability to move beyond the numbers and illustrate what impact it's having on someone individually or on a community. Because those are the stories that have that lasting impact. And I think those reporters who keep that in mind, and it's evident in their reporting, are the ones that are that get it.
How did you balance being Asian and American in the United States? If there's a dichotomy of the Asian culture that you grew up being a Pakistani American, and then there's the dichotomy of being growing up in a country like America, where there is diversity of cultures, but there's also a prominent non-Pakistani culture, right? So how did you balance that dichotomy in your path to success in your career, in your life, with your family? How have you managed that?
I think with regard to my family, if you know, we're raised to respect our elders. And I think, you know, Asian Americans in particular have a healthy relationship with their culture in the sense that it's ingrained into who they are. It's, you know, the food, the language, you know, the smells, the music, all of that. And we come from a very rich, rich culture. So that appreciation has always been there. And I've seen it as a strength rather than a barrier. But there have been times where you have to figure out whether this is a situation where you need to assimilate in order to succeed, or if this is a situation where you can use your background to gain leverage. And by that, I mean being able to tell stories that you're poised to tell because of who you are and the experiences you have or the access that that commands. So, I mean, it's a constant, we have two small kids now, and my daughter is learning all the songs that my mom used to sing to me when I was little. And she can sing them, but she doesn't know what they mean necessarily. And I'm acutely aware of the fact that she's not going to be fluent in Urdu the way that I am. My parents worked very hard to make sure I was fluent. My mom refused to answer us if we didn't speak to her in Urdu.
Mm-hmm.
And that coupled with spending, you know, 3 months or 2.5 months abroad every other summer, immersed in the language is why we are. You know, it takes a lot of work.
You said that your culture is your strength, that, you know, you view your culture as your strength. What is the strength that it brings?
I think that the strength that having a separate culture in a homogenous society, like where our formative years are, creates resiliency, which serves you throughout your life in various facets. And so that's one thing I feel I have in common with all immigrants. We are resilient.
If you enjoyed this episode of Identity Unveiled, we would love to hear from you. Visit us at identityunveiled.org and send us your feedback. And we always welcome nominees for future podcast guests that you would love to hear from.